My name is Kim Bettner. I'm 64 years old. Today is October 29th, 2021, and I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and I'm speaking with my One Small Step partner, Mike Birkenhoff.
And my name is Mike Birkenhoff. I am 37 years old. Today's date is October 29th, 2021. I'm in Houston, Texas. And I'm speaking with my one small step partner, Kim Bettner.
Mike, you can answer first. Why did you want to do this interview today?
I always, it's always a good question to reflect on why we do things. For me, it's just meeting new people and getting different ideas. Growing up in Texas, while in this day and age, 2021, we're getting a lot of transplants, we still have a very, very strong culture. And it's a very connected culture. And so any chance I get to converse with people from outside of my state, outside of my country, I absolutely jump on it.
So I wanted to do this interview today because I'm insatiably curious about people. I love hearing their stories. I love hearing their background. I had, when I was about 40, I'd never sung in my life. And I had someone, the choir director at church said, "You can sing." And I'm like, "No, I can't sing." And he's like, "No, you can sing." And over the course of a couple of years, turns out I'm not a professional, but I can sing. But one of the things that I learned is that I have to carry my part in the choir. So that when in a choir, you get four parts, you get six parts, and the director puts it all together. My part, I carry my part and let it all get woven together and respect that other people have their parts and they're different than my parts. So I enjoy listening to other people's stories, hearing where they come from and how they work.
It really was.
The second question is to read your partner's bio out loud as written. And What in the bio would you like to know more about? So I'm going to share that in the chat. It's kind of long. Kim.
You're an angel. I was like, we're going to hurry fly to my email client.
Of course. Kim, Mike's is at the top next to M. So you can read his and ask any questions you have.
Let me see if I can get to the top. How do I get to the top? I had to figure out how to get there. I see mine at the bottom.
Yeah, if you just scroll a little higher.
You think I can scroll, but I
don't
see.
If anything, I can just reshare his portion.
Yeah, I don't see a place to scroll.
Yeah, no worries. How's this? Can you see it now?
I still see my. Oh, there he is. Mike, I am in my late 30s and have lived in Texas all my life. My political and social views are on the conservative side. They are just in line with the written version of the Constitution and the belief that a person should have the right to chart their way, whether that be successful or not. If I am on the successful side of that journey, I feel it is my responsibility to help those around me if they need a hand up. I want to spread light and love with others so that the world is more bearable. Nice.
I know, did I write that? Oh, all right, and Kim, reading your bio here, I am an engineer
and
who works in industrial automation. My career has taken me into factories, quarries, and underground mines. My husband, John, and I have been married for 42 years and raised four children together. I grew up in a small town in Illinois and was the first in my family to graduate from college. We moved to Birmingham in 1996. My faith as a Christian is central to who I am. My faith leads me to protest systematic racism, poverty, ecological damage, and unequal access to healthcare in Alabama.
For Is there anything you'd like to know more about that was mentioned?
Yeah, Mike, I'd like to ask. So you're in your late 30s and you've lived in Texas all of your life. Same big town, small town, rural area?
So predominantly Houston and different parts of Houston, if you're familiar with, you know, nice big Target. And we're adding another ring now for satellites. But lived on the west side of Houston. I now live on the southeast side of Houston. For 5 to 6 years, I went to college in North Texas. That was a small town. And then moved to the Fort Worth area for a little bit. I said it, I always tell people or jokingly say that I needed to get a worldly idea, so I moved to North Texas.
Nice.
Give me just a second to shut my window so y'all don't hear the landscapers. Sorry about that. They decided to come late today. Kim, I'm actually interested in your profession, industrial automation. So factories, quarries, and mines, are you working with PLCs or DCS systems?
Nice, both. I do both. Cool. I work for a company called Rockwell Automation.
Hey, Alan Bradley's.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So what kind of work do you do?
I am a salesperson for an organization that represents Emerson's Delta V.
Sure. So I am old enough that I was one of the engineers who wrote the design specs for the PLC 5.
Whoa!
So yeah, nice. Oh, so yeah. Similar. So you've had similar experience to mine. My favorite part about the job is going into places and having people make stuff. I love helping people make stuff. Yes. Yeah.
So I guess in your area, it looks like it's more mining, and mine is more petrochem and refining. And it's just the coolest thing in the world to see what people are making and doing, and knowing that the chemical vessel next to you, if it ruptures, that's it.
That's not good. Yeah.
It's still rad to go see.
So I've gotten an opportunity to, I've done automotive. I've eaten cornflakes warm off the line at Kellogg's.
Oh my gosh.
I got to watch Dow Chemical make Glad Wrap. I had to, I've worked on rides at Universal Studios. Every automobile that is assembled in the country, I've been in that plant. So yeah, but I have been, one of the best things is I did get to go in an underground mine a couple of times. I've been in the underground mines at Brookwood. And then also in Galena, Illinois. So, and watch them do longwall coal mining there. So, yeah.
That'd be so cool to see.
Yeah.
We don't have any of those in Texas. At least in my part.
That's right.
I can tell you about petrochemical plants and oil refineries, but yeah, never been underground.
We do specialty chemical on the Gulf Coast. So, but not big chemical like you guys do it. You guys do big stuff.
Yeah.
So what made you stay around Houston?
You both, who has been the
so most... If I could, I would live in North Texas. Absolutely love the community up there, people that live there, the atmosphere. The weather's awesome, except for that little patch in the springtime when the tornadoes come through. Otherwise, I'm okay with the somewhat cold winters compared to other parts of the country, and then the blistering hot summers. But it came down to when we started a family, it's like, okay, well, we're going to need some more funding for life. And if you're going to play in Texas in sales, which is what my profession is, you're going to need to be in oil and gas, since that's the predominant industry. Oil, gas, I guess petrochem, but that brought me back to Houston. And so we're here until we get enough to retire, and then we'll probably move to Central Texas, probably closer to Austin, San Antonio.
I grew up in a little town in downstate Illinois, and my grandparents were farmers. And it was I swear to you, I graduated from a class of 130, and it was a great place to be from. I'm so thankful that I am from there. It just wasn't big enough for me or diverse enough. I got an opportunity to go to college and saw, I got a shot at the wider world and have found that to be endlessly fascinating to me. I still have a brother that lives there, but he lives within 10 miles of where we grew up. And I'm just like, oh, I love you, but man, I couldn't do this. I couldn't live this close to home. So.
Yeah, I could sympathize with that. It's kind of what led me to North Texas. But even when we moved back to Houston, we're still an hour away from where I grew up, which in Houston's, you know, close.
But close, that's close.
But in other parts of the world, it's not. No, that background's interesting that you grew up in a small town. It sounds very reminiscent of my wife's upbringing, but she grew up in a small farming community outside of Austin. Visiting there, I've always, you know, just loved how all the farmers have to get together and help each other, and no one person successful without the other. So neat thing to see.
My son-in-law, one of my son-in-laws is a farmer at heart. Man, if he could, his family owns about 250 acres, about an hour away from Birmingham. And he would love, I mean, his happy place is sitting on a tractor and bush hogging or cutting grass and doing that kind of stuff. But he couldn't, he's a smart man, and he knows that it's not enough to feed his family. It's not reliable enough to feed his family. So, and that's what my grandparents never owned it. They farmed the land for the folks that owned it. So never had two nickels to rub together and just couldn't make a go of it, you know? So farming is tough. Farming is tough.
It really, really is. And from what I've seen, at least, even if you can make it, it's a pretty hard life.
It is.
Of you know, ups and downs and long work days and you know, just trying to manage, I guess, what would be a small business.
Yeah.
And some pretty chaotic changes to the process you have.
It will spoil you though for store bought tomatoes.
Oh, won't it though? I will say that's the problem with living in a suburb is you can't have a big garden, and we only get a handful of tomatoes a year.
Yep. We cultivate. We haunt the farmers markets because they know what they're doing, and I'm happy to support them.
No, that's good. So let's see, four kids, are they around y'all or did they disperse as well?
So I was an efficient professional woman. I had three children in 36 months. And then I was,
wait a minute.
yeah. And then I thought we were done. And then hit the road because I was doing promotion at the time. We were launching the PLC 5 stuff and came back after 10 days on the road, and there was a fire in the fireplace and a bottle of wine in the fridge. And 6 weeks later, I was standing in my boss's office going, this was a work-related accident. So we have four children. The oldest is my daughter, Jessie, and my middleest daughter, Katie, live within about 5 minutes of us with their husbands. And we have, between the two, we had four grandchildren that are 9, 8, 7, and 5. And then our son, Bob, is in, he and his wife are in Charleston, South Carolina. And my daughter, Lizzie, is in Baltimore. She's living in Baltimore with her boyfriend, Justin. So interesting places to visit, and we get to go trick-or-treating with the kids. How about you?
No, that's awesome. No, mine are young, so they still are firmly planted underneath underneath our roof for now. Nice. Now we have a 7.5-year-old, an almost 6-year-old, and a 4-year-old, just turned 4-year-old in September.
So. Nice. What flavor did you get? Boys, girls?
We have 2 girls, so those are the younger two, and then our oldest is a boy.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So it's parenthood's fun.
It's fun. Yes. 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 Yes, it is. So, yeah.
Influential person in your life, and what did they teach you? I'm going to pass that to Michael to go first.
Most influential person. Oh, that's a tough one. There's quite a bit of people I draw from. What I like to do is study individuals, whether famous or not, and get an understanding of how they work. You know, what's been their successes, what's been their defeats, how have they grown from that, and what knowledge can I kind of capture from them to better, you know, kind of better what I'm doing or trying to do, you know, to progress my, you know, my human personal experience. Here of late, I've been drawing a lot from the retired military community, folks like Jocko Willick, Mark Lissatrell. I guess it seems to be special forces and somehow specifically Navy SEALs that keep popping on my radar. I've just kind of seen how they dealt with their stripes while in, you know, the war theater and then back here at home, and the lessons you learn. Specifically for me, Jocko has taught a ton of leadership material or put content out there that I've learned from, and just, you know, teaches you to be a more, you know, more well-rounded person and how to interact with others. And if you're trying to motivate someone to a shared goal, you know, how does that work? On top of that, probably the last, I don't know, 10, 11 years, Glenn Beck has been a big influence of mine as well. His ideas of, you know, faith, hope, and charity, and giving back to others, and just trying to make the country, or his part of the country, I guess you would say, in his community, an audience just a little bit better, so that we can help everyone else out, less divisive, and, you know, just a better part of the U.S. And like I said, there's ups and downs. I've seen him do awesome things, and I've seen him make some comments and do some things. I was like, ooh, brother, I don't know if I'd have done that one. But that's the cool thing about being, you know, a human, is we all have that. We have all those successes and things we learn from, is what I say.
So I would say early on, I was, you know, I was one of those kids in high school that I was just kind of geeky. I like math. I like science. I had a math teacher in high school. Her name was Polly Wilson, Mrs. Wilson, and she had an engineering degree. It was the first person I met who'd had an engineering degree. Couldn't get a job as an engineer in the early 70s. Nobody would hire her as an engineer. Mm-hmm. And so she went to work as a teacher, but she encouraged me to go to college and study engineering. And so I did, loved it, loved the problem solving aspect of it, loved that just the how you put things together, how that whole process for problem solving I found pretty useful in life. And then when I went to work out of college, I had a number of folks that I worked with. One of them was a gentleman named Steve Eisenbrown, and he was huge. He's like 6'8", and big guy, big voice, loud, but had a high degree of integrity, just immense degree of integrity. And we were in an environment, not many women, not much, pretty rough in some of the places that we hung out. I loved the work, but it was challenging to be a woman in that environment, and put up with a lot of things that I wish I hadn't put up with. Steve was the manager who was absolutely over the top adamant that none of that was happening on his watch. He was tolerating none of it. And he was the first manager that I had who absolutely had my back and absolutely held people accountable for their actions. And that level of integrity and that level of leadership, I found really inspiring.
Yeah, I've obviously younger in the workplace. I started, 2006? Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of naive thought process there, because it's never been forward and center. But especially once I had daughters, I had to start asking that question, like, hey, you know, professional lady that I've been working with now for a few years, who's been in the industry way longer than me, how bad was it and is it? And holy moly, some of the stories I heard, I'm like, that's beyond uncalled for. I mean, that is like, how can a dude even do that? You know, mm-hmm. say that or behave that way? So yeah, it blew my mind. And a question I always ask them, and then I'll extend it to you, Kim, if you want to answer it, is, you know, how do you teach your daughters to be strong? You know, hopefully that environment's still not around, but I'm unfortunately biased to one gender, so I may not always see it. Mm-hmm. But how do you kind of teach your daughters to survive in that environment and thrive?
It is still around. It is not, in my experience, as bad as it was in the 80s. The 80s were pretty horrific. Yeah. The 90s were slightly better, but not much better. Would say that as I mentor women doing things like this and whatever, is that you've got to have the courage to be authentically who you are. And what you'll find if you do that, my experience has been, is that I've found, and the term that I would use for them are allies who have my back, allies who will speak out and say the right thing. Because the thing that happens, Mike, is not when they're in the room, it's when they're out of the room.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And when they're out of the room, if people will allow that sly joke or that degrading comment, if they allow that to pass, then that undermines the conversation, that undermines their ability to be effective. So finding allies, identifying those allies, and allowing those allies to be able to speak for you is really important. It's really important. Now, having said that, as a woman, you've got to be courageous. You gotta, you know, if you're in the choir, you gotta sing your own part. Yeah. Right? You can't wait for Prince Charming to come and rescue you. So we raised our daughters. My husband and I raised our daughters. Everybody needs to be able to take care of themselves and the people they love, Our daughters were not raised expecting that somebody would come along and take care of them. Our son wasn't raised that way either. but they're raised to be able to take care of themselves, to have some common sense, do some things. And it goes equally well for boys. You got to be able to, our son has to be, he has to be able to do his own laundry. He has to be able to cook. You know, you ought to know where the cutoff is in the house for the water coming in. There's some things that if you're human, you ought to know how to change a diaper, you know, everybody ought to know that stuff.
You learn that quick as a parent. Mm-hmm.
Does that help?
No, it really does. I you still hear those sly comments too. And you do it, for at least for me, it's just disgusting. It's like, bro, you don't have to go there, you know?
Right.
You don't have to go there. Thankfully, I haven't seen, because I've heard stories from the 80s and the 90s. And so thankfully, I haven't had experience any of that. I know in my profession, sales, and I don't know if this is just what was in my industry or maybe it was in other industries, but I heard that, you know, it used to be expected that you're bringing your customers to a strip club and that's just what you're going to do.
Yep.
And I'm like, no, I'm like, yeah, you know, if I was in that situation and I'm like, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I respect my wife too much, my kids. And, you know, I'm not going to be part of that one bit. And thankfully, I haven't had to deal with it, but I imagine it's still out there.
Yep. I believe it is.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was, and I imagine it is.
Yep.
That's a good question.
Yeah, those are great answers. The last question for me is, could you briefly describe in your own words your personal political values? And I'll ask Kim to answer this first.
So if I were to define my political values, I believe simply that community matters, that we're connected, that we are tied to each other, and that in order for me and for my family to thrive, that the people around me, my neighbors and my friends, need to thrive as well. I think that high levels of trust are important, and so these kinds of conversations, where even people that I disagree with politically, if we're still neighbors. At the end of the day, we're still neighbors. So having those kinds of respectful conversations and working through hard issues together is what I would expect of my political folks. But I expect that we contribute to a community, we share in a community, and we build a community together.
Yeah, that I 100% agree. I know in our little cul-de-sac here in our little subdivision, you know, it's if there's a hurricane coming, you know, we're running everybody's doors. Hey, y'all set? Y'all good? You know, mm-hmm. Holler if you need something. I may not run across the street during 70 mile an hour winds, but
no.
I'll catch you as soon as it's over with. And when it is, you know, we're out. Hey, you good with generators? You good with gas? You know, you know, we like to get together and have a subdivision or maybe, you know, street parties just to get to know people. But then you grow that, and I'm big in my church, so make sure all those folks are taken care of. And, you know, when you get to a level that you're supporting everybody, okay, well, let's grow that onion a little bit more to where, you know, we were part of a group of folks that were raising, you know, millions of dollars to pull Afghanistan people out of harm's way a few months ago. And it's the human experience, and we're all linked together. So yes, I absolutely would say that community needs to be there to make sure that, you know, everyone's taken care of. As I look at that question, though, personal political views, politically, and this would go in the form of governance, I want a government that's protecting my natural rights, and more specifically, the ones defined, in the document we all agree to as a constitution. And when things start getting out of line with that, and there's more encroachment from the government into my individual life, that's where I start getting rubbed. And the more emotional side comes out with how you deal with political values. And it's just trying to walk through that and balance those two. For me, I don't so much rely on the government to provide the aid. What I want to do is have the community and the individuals provide the aid. So, an individual starts with the idea, it grows into a small group, a larger group, a bigger group, a community, a town, a city, a state, a country, to help out and make sure that, that person coming up behind you has a hand to grab and be pulled up.
I would agree with that, but I live in a community in Birmingham where historically the laws were not enacted in a way that allowed everybody to have access to those same levels of freedom. So I've had the privilege of spending some time with some of the folks that marched in Birmingham. And in the Children's March in 1963, I've spent time with men who were convicted of crimes that they didn't commit, and 32 years later, when they finally that conviction's overturned, it still took 5 years to get him out of prison. So the Constitution is for me a good starting point, but where it started, I didn't have rights as a woman. Black people didn't have rights, and so I think we're a work in progress. And as we reach out to other communities, some communities are isolated and they don't have the resources. And to me, correcting that is really important. I think that's how we build trust and how we build peace. I will tell you right now, there's an exercise that we're all going through where we're deciding what our voting districts are, right? For their reapportioning,
yep.
Every 10 years. There's a, in Alabama, the gerrymandering is blatant and it's one-sided. Now, I believe both Democrats and Republicans engage in that. But I will tell you, in Alabama, it's pretty horrific and there is no shame about how it's being done. And I find that problematic.
No, absolutely. We have plenty of awkward looking districts in Texas, mm-hmm. and specifically in Houston, that make no, if my understanding is correct of the original idea of the districts, it was to link those people that were more closely aligned to a shared idea because they live right next to each other, the original idea, or at least in close proximity once you get into rural areas or farms. But with some of the districts I've seen, I'm like, it's 2-3 streets wide and running straight down this little area and then quick flippy making a jog over here and over there. So yeah, I never thought that priceless was correct. I will admit, I don't know what the right answer is, but I've never, like, something about that doesn't, yeah, you can't, it's not there.
So there's in Alabama, there's a proposal by the League of Women Voters that's called the whole county proposal, where you take folks, you just take entire counties, because that's a structure that already existed as a governance, right? And if you do a whole county proposal, it falls well within the lines of representation and doing that. But what it does is it breaks up. It we get more blended and less polarized, and our legislature is absolutely adamant that they will not do anything like that, because there's no political gain to it. And exactly. I think on all sides, until we stand together and say it doesn't matter whether it's Democratic gerrymandering or Republican gerrymandering or somebody guy doing some other gerrymandering, unless we force our elected leaders to do something that is transparent and fair, that we're gonna continue to struggle.
If y'all were to go to the county idea, does it balance out with the number of representatives y'all have? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So, simple example, biggest city in Alabama is Birmingham.
Right.
Right now, Birmingham is somewhere in the neighborhood of 70% Black. Under the proposal that's being put forward by the Republican legislator, they split it up across three different districts. Instead of allowing,
one voting block. No.
So they break it up so that there might, so that majority Black county winds up in three different, they wind up as minority populations in three different white districts.
Is Birmingham all in one county?
Mm-hmm. Jefferson. Okay. Yeah.
And if it was like Houston and spread. Mm-hmm. I think Houston has three or four now. I'm not even sure.
Yeah. So I think you know, whether it's my tribe, the other tribe, somebody else's tribe, until we hold each other accountable, I find it disappointing that we're not holding everyone accountable to that same thing.
Yeah, because I guess I don't know, I haven't done any research in it, but if you looked at, or maybe other areas, you would see that as well.
Oh yeah.
On the other side. And so
without a doubt.
It goes back to the idea of, it's not right. I don't know how to fix it, but it's not right.
It's not right. But I think we have to figure out how to fix it.
So, absolutely.
I think there's the media has built a business model in this country where they profit on polarizing us. And so I'm very happy to have conversations with real live people, you know, because I think it's an antidote to turn off the television, turn off my social media feed, and have real conversations with real people and see if we can't figure some stuff out.
And that's what I feel is the key to getting back to normalcy, is that it's not, we'll call the far right or the far left, and what we see from our media contents, like you said, whether that's social or radio or TV or whatever it might be now, it is just having those conversations, because we're not all that different. You know, it's we're all folks just trying to earn a living and make sure everyone around us is taken care of. And when we have those conversations, I feel it pulls us closer together.
So you spoke earlier about folks coming from Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. We are, my little liberal church that we're involved in is active. We think by the end of the year, we will be in the process of resettling about 50 families from Afghanistan that are through something called Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services. Is the second largest organization after Catholic Charities to do that. But we've been active in immigration and immigration reform for years. But those families, we're working to make a place for those families here and hoping that they will be welcome, trying to do everything we can to try to make them welcome.
That is awesome. They'll be there in Alabama?
Yeah, they're finding that places where they would normally want to go, which is places where other Afghans have settled, like Northern Virginia and some of those places, unaffordable. They're unaffordable, and so they
Northern Virginia, yes.
yeah. Some of those places where, so they're looking to resettle. They initially looked at Atlanta, so Baltimore, Northern Virginia. They looked at Atlanta, and now they've spread out to Birmingham because it's way more affordable.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. That's good to hear. I love those stories.
Yeah.
You know, those folks were dealt a pretty hard blow here recently, and it's like, no, man, I hate seeing someone suffer like that, and you know, I want to get them squared away where they can be safe and happy and prosperous again.
But I will tell you that infrastructure exists here because we've been doing that for years for immigrants from Guatemala and Honduras.
Good.
So we've been practicing.
And how does that work? Do y'all acclimate them to, I guess, the area and the community?
So they when they come, they come and we will have resources, including things like most of them will come with virtually nothing.
Yeah.
And so set them up with apartments, set them up with furniture, help them get their children enrolled in school, help them figure out how to get employment, support them with resources in the community that ideally that are folks that are from their own cultural background that can help them acclimate and do that. But simple example, computers for high school kids, right? So last year, the last thing we did before we went into lockdown is deliver a set of computers to a family that had just gotten here from Honduras, had made the trip from Honduras because the 15-year-old son had been threatened that unless he joined a gang, the entire family would be killed. And so they did what I would have done. They picked up their family and they ran. That's what I would have done, you know, to keep my family safe. And when they got here, we tried to figure out how to help them.
That's awesome. I like that a lot.
We find that a lot of, in some places, people show up without documentation because the documentation doesn't exist anymore.
Never existed, right?
Right. And so, you know, we talk about the Constitution and the laws, but I think that the immigration system is broken.
Yes.
I think that that both the Democrats and Republicans are making bank by polarizing us, and we need to sit down together and fix it. We just need to fix it. We need, the borders do need to be secure, but we also need to take care of people. And people that have enough gumption to pick up and grab their kids and run to save their lives. I don't think we should be keeping those folks out.
No, I agree. Especially in Texas. What's happening to the south of us is can be a nightmare.
Yeah.
And so when those folks get here, you know, make sure they're taken care of and squared away. But at the same time, There's a lot of people crossing over that river that aren't good characters at all.
And, I agree.
Those are the ones we're trying to keep out.
Yep. But I don't think it's an either or. I think it's a both and. We got to do both.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I've always felt the immigration system, I don't even know a nice word to say about it, but it needs an extreme overhaul. That, mm-hmm. you know, the pathway that my family used to get here, you know, 4 or 5 generations ago, made sense. The pathway for an individual to get here now, you know what, it takes 7 years and thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, maybe even to get them, you know, get them naturalized if they want to be.
If they can be.
You're just like, man, if you want to come here and make this a better place, I do not want to stop you. You know, mm-hmm. I want you to absolutely have that ability mm-hmm. and, you know, have the right to chart your own path and make your own way.
So what else would you like to ask me?
Let's see, what can we, so do you link your, how do I put this? When it comes to support, we'll say, disparaged folks, mm-hmm. you know, just looking for a hand up or trying to get going, do you link it more to a government idea or a community? And for me, I always go to my church would be mm-hmm. the way. Which one would you go towards?
So I think it's both. So we try to do both. And I'll give you an example. My husband and I went on Wednesday night. There's a homeless man's shelter here in Birmingham, the firehouse shelter. And there are men that are on the street for whatever reason. And every couple of months we go, we gather up and we go feed them dinner. Hmm. We fed 76 on Wednesday night, right? And just go and spend time with them and feed them dinner. And so that's something that we do. But I will tell you as well that I believe that there's systemic issues and we have to fix the systemic issues. And I think it is on the government and us as citizens to work to fix the systemic issues. And a simple example of that might be in Alabama, they voters' rights. About 5 years ago, the Secretary of State shut all of the driver's license bureaus within the Black Belt. So if you're a person of color and you live in the rural part of the state, which is primarily Black, you now have to show 4 forms of identification. You have to drive 2 hours, and to try to get your driver's license, even if you've never driven. So when we say should people have documentation, they should. Do I want documentation when we go to vote? We do. I do. Do I want it to be, if you're a citizen, should it be tremendously difficult and expensive to get that? No, it shouldn't be. But we work hard here to make it difficult for people to do that. And it marginalizes people who are poor and people of color. And so I think that the government, it is on the government to fix those things. I think it's on us as citizens to fix those things, to correct those. And that means it takes money to do that. Same thing about schools. We can talk about this, the difference in funding of schools, right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. More property value you have, the I guess the better the schools are, the more you can get a bond passed, I guess, these days and age, at least in my part of the world.
Yeah. So should we be funding those others? Yeah. I need those guys to be educated. I need them to be able to take jobs that are high-tech jobs. I need them to be good citizens and educated about the Constitution. But that means I'm going to have to fund it because they can't fund it themselves.
And I think that's where I'm at too, is just trying to figure out the avenue to funding that. But yeah, I want everyone to have that equal shot.
Yeah.
To, you know, if you want to make something of yourself, the pathway's there. I'm not going to hinder it. The only hindrance will be, you know, your own self-discipline and how creative you can make it. But
we're going to have to fund it. I think we're going to have to fund it. So
there are a few closing questions. The first is there anything you learned about me today that surprised you? And Mike, you can take this one first. Is there anything you learned about Kim, not about me?
Yeah, so she worked on the original PLC 5. Oh yeah, no, I learned a lot about myself. No, that she worked on the original PLC 5. I know it's nerdy and very profession, you know, centric, but that's awesome because I see those everywhere.
But
aside from that, on the more personal level, no, I really, really enjoyed the dialogue we had with the daughter's part. That's something that I wrestle with. So learning, you know, from you and your experiences and how you trained your kids was really, really beneficial. And I appreciate it.
Thank you. I was tickled to death to find somebody in the profession. That is awesome. Yeah. That is awesome to hear and to do. It does not, I'll tell you what doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that you take care of your neighbors, that it's important to you to go out and to help other people. That did not surprise me at all. I'm happy to have spent the time.
Thank you.
And the last question is, was I who you expected me to be? And Kim, you can answer this one first.
Was Mike who I expected him to be? I would say that I am a blue dot in a very red state. I would tell you that my experience with my friends that are more conservative than I am, and most everyone is more conservative than I am, is that they are good folks at heart. That they are good folks. And so I expected that. I expected you to find someone with a good heart. So, yes.
And I'll mirror Kim's statement there too. I believe that people are inherently good. That coming across an actual person that means malcontent is, you know, very, very far in between. So I absolutely expected Kim to be a nice, loving person that we could have a conversation with together.
Come on.
No. It's Friday. Grammar's not going to be doing good.
Well, thank you both for joining us today for your recording. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Naya, for tracking me down. I swear I was sitting in a room by myself feeling unloved. So thank you. You've made my day.
Thank you, Naya.